You're listening to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. What's your favorite flower? Mine changes depending on when you ask me. Depends on my age, my circumstances, my mood, the season, God knows what. For a long time, for instance, I hated sunflowers. I thought they were ugly. Now I can't understand that. Who was that crazy person who didn't like sunflowers? They're so gorgeous. Now I buy them at the local farmer's market all the time. I also love pansies, calla lilies, roses, but what woman doesn't, peonies, hydrangea. I am, however, blissfully ignorant of the symbolism of these flowers, for they do have symbolism. Throughout history, in different parts of the world, at different times, flowers and all plants held rich connotations. Painters and poets have long relied on botanical symbolism to convey their ideas. But though a rose by any other name may smell as sweet, it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing to different people. Neither do gardens. Different ethnic and racial groups look upon gardens and public green spaces differently. It's a fascinating cultural phenomenon, and one that producer Judith Kampfner explores in today's program. It's called Every Tree Tells a Story.
The rain falls softly on Marvi Sharmi's striped umbrella. The British weather doesn't stop her taking a Sunday lunchtime stroll across this little London park. The blossoms have been dropping off the trees in the last week. It's Marvi's first spring here.
My window actually overlooks the park, and I've always found it really nice because of that white tree you have over there. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's cherry blossoms. But it's really nice because when the flowers were all white and the sun used to shine on it, from my window it used to look like it was glowing. It was so pretty.
A tree can look enchanting by day, she says, but it's totally different at night.
Because if you look at horror films also, they always bring these old trees which are sort of like banging against the window. Yeah, so at night, trees are scary, especially in the winter when they're without the leaves and everything.
Back home in Pakistan, Marvi's grandmother told her stories about jinns, supernatural spirits who live in trees and come out at night. They're not just children's stories, they're Pakistani Muslim legends.
So you're not supposed to go near the trees at night because, you know, they're haunted and the jinns might come and possess you or attack you or something. And I guess it was meant to keep kids away from the trees in the middle of the night, at dark, in the dark time, so that they don't get hurt or something because there are creatures and all around, such as snakes and bugs and cockroaches and stuff like that, and lizards. But what was interesting also was how they'd say you don't break trees. And we were told that, you know, it's because the jinns have their babies in there. And if you cut them, you'll kill them and then the jinn will come and haunt you for life. And, you know, he'll make your life living hell.
She remembers climbing an oak in northern Pakistan. Here in central London, in this small enclosed garden, there are about 30 good-sized trees.
I personally feel parks are used more in the West, particularly in England, in the summer because it's warm and nice. In Pakistan, it just gets too hot to go to the parks.
Marvi likes the fact that London is dotted with green patches. This little garden has distinct areas, so it seems much bigger. Paths spiral over the lawn, cutting it into different shaped areas. There's a place with exotic flowers, a section with traditional British wooden benches, and another with climbing logs and a playhouse. And at the centre of the lawn is a rustic barbecue area under a circle of ancient lime trees. In Pakistani cities, it's different, says Marvi.
These are truly, like, these are one of the oldest, like, they remind me of the old countryside back home with old, old trees.
So what you're saying is really interesting. You're saying that you don't associate old, old trees with the city. You associate that with the country.
Yeah.
Because for you, cities are relatively new developments.
There's relatively new developments, and sadly, they're more concrete.
Marvi's window looks out onto this park. She uses it every day, rain or shine. She goes jogging around the gravel track which skirts the lawn. But there are some new immigrants who don't venture into London's parks. Across town, Ros Brewer is the landscape manager of the parks in Tower Hamlets. This neighbourhood by the River Thames Docklands has a new population. Ros is particularly worried about Somali women.
We think that women, particularly from certain ethnic minority groups, are underrepresented in our users. There is anecdotal evidence of people who live in tower blocks overlooking some of our parks who don't actually use the parks. They don't know why they would go in there.
The largest park in Ros's district is Victoria Park, which was built in 1869. She says she'll maintain the traditional design, which is an essential part of British heritage. But she's thinking about landscaping a new area just for women. Her vision is to recreate a traditional garden in the style of the grand palaces of the Mughals.
The Mughals were Muslim rulers of India in, I think, about the 15th century, and they had a very beautiful style of garden design that's based around square rectangular gardens with paths and bodies of water that represent paradise, paradise on earth. These are gardens, little Taj Mahal gardens. That would be a very obvious link with the principal local ethnic minority communities around here, but I'm not clear that we could exclude men from it, whether it would be proper to do so.
Park authorities aren't the only people trying to introduce immigrants to public spaces.
If people are not introduced and purposefully welcomed into parks, sometimes they are unsure if that's somebody else's territory. And if they go onto it, they can be, you know, felt like you are some sort of intrusion.
Judy Ling Wong is a Hong Kong-born Chinese woman who's passionate about helping parks cater to ethnic communities. She runs an organisation called the Black Environment Network, even though most of its members aren't black.
We actually use the word symbolically because we want to recognise that the black communities are the most visible and very often have the worst time as ethnic minorities. But the rest of us as ethnic minorities identify with that experience.
Judy also works with communities directly, helping them plant and design spaces so that they feel more at home. Recently, elders from a West London Asian association approached her. They wanted to plant palms around a house they'd converted into a mosque.
And the reason why they wanted palm trees was that it was symbolic of the first gatherings under the palm trees to worship God. And I don't know if you know about this, but there are hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of palm trees. And some of them actually, like the Chusen palm, can survive down to minus 32.
If she were to pick trees as a symbol of her own culture, Judy said she'd go for flowering fruit trees. They make her think of Chinese New Year, and they appear in Chinese stories.
You might know of the Chinese monkey stories, which are very, very traditional and legendary, and it's all about the exploits of the monkey, which actually cannot be killed.
Monkey was hatched from a magical egg on a mountain top. He was crowned Sun Wukong, the Monkey King, after he proved to be the only monkey on Hua Guo Shan, the mountain of the fruit and flowers, to dare to go through the water curtain and set up a kingdom on earth. Upon realizing that he was going to die like everyone else, he made it his goal to become immortal. Things came to a peak when he ate peaches from Yuhuang Dadi, the Jade Emperor's sacred peach tree. The peaches of immortality had made him truly indestructible.
London's Chinatown is tiny. It's only a few narrow streets. I live both in New York and London, and I love New York's bustling Chinatown. But when it gets too noisy, there's a haven, a long, narrow park. It's Sarah Roosevelt Park, at the corner of Bowery and Houston. No peach trees here, and no monkey, but plenty of prized songbirds. I'm looking at them with Erica Svensson of the USDA Forest Service. She's a social forester, she says, interested in how people and trees coexist.
This is the Wame Bird Garden, the songbirds that some of the Chinese elders, usually men, come out in the early morning around 6 and bring their songbirds out to bask in the sun. And you can see that the cages are placed within the garden here, and the men are sitting kind of talking, having coffee, and just enjoying the morning.
So these men have come to walk their birds. Every few minutes, a new man and bird arrive, and the owner uncovers the cage. When his bird starts to sing, the owner walks out to the benches, always keeping a watchful eye. I walk up to get a closer look at the small birds. They all have identical black circles around their eyes, as if they were wearing heavy coal makeup, like the singers in the Peking Opera. And then I realize that a man is shouting at me. Obviously, I'm intruding on a special ritual.
This is an incredibly spiritual experience for people to be in a public space, but yet be in a private space. And I think that's what we're witnessing right now.
Different landscapes are beloved by different cultures.
A lot of the Icelandic sagas are based around trees, the tree called Yggdrasil.
In Norse mythology, the Yggdrasil is a sacred ash with branches that shelter the world. That's what a British academic tells me. Julian Adjeman of Afro-European Heritage is a professor of urban planning at Tufts University. He coined the term cultural ecology, the study of how people interact with nature. You can learn a lot from the folk tales of different countries, he explains. Trees can be symbols of healing, wealth, success, fertility, good luck, be a sanctuary.
A lot of cultures revere trees. A lot of immigrants will have a lot of stories about trees, and we can use those stories. I mean, imagine if one park were to build up a bank of stories about trees and publish them, put them on signage.
Adjeman says some visitors to parks want botanical information, but others might want to know why some trees are special in other cultures. I've noticed that there's a new wave of Russian immigrants coming to Hampstead Heath in North London, where I grew up. Elchin Suleiman, who's been living in this country for 5 years, comes here for the birch groves, a piece of Russia in England, he says.
Trees and woods that usually mean something more for Russians, and especially birch tree. It's something so deep in Russian soul that when you see this birch tree, you can't stand. It's a symbol of Mother Russia, of young virgin woman.
So if a Russian is homesick, all he has to do is find a birch tree. Once upon a time, there was an old peasant in Russia who fell asleep under a birch.
He was suddenly woken up by a handsome young stranger. "There is going to be a storm," said the stranger. "You should not lie under a tree. You should be on your way." The peasant thanked the young man, and in return he said, "One day when you are far from home and lonely and in danger, you will see a crooked birch tree. Strike it like this, strike it 3 times and ask to go home." And you know what, several years later, when the man was a soldier in Finland, he was homesick and desperate. Remembering what the peasant had said, he was suddenly surprised by the appearance of a crooked birch. He struck it and instantly was transported away from the woe to his home.
Wherever you live, whatever the environment, if you can plant something to remind you of home, you feel more rooted. But in some areas, it's difficult to get a tree to grow. In New York, I'm in Hunts Point in the South Bronx, a residential area in amongst waste transfer plants. A storekeeper called Big Lou says there's only one tree per acre here.
Well, there's only a few trees in the neighborhood, but I mean, it'd be nice if there was a lot more trees. And then the old ones, they could fix them or something and, you know, do something with them or, you know, something. But yeah, it'd be nice if there was more trees in the neighborhood. Much more.
Is there a lot of traffic and fumes?
Yeah, there's a lot of trucks that come by the neighborhood, and I guess that's what really hurts the trees. And, you know, but, you know, I mean, this it'd be nice if there was more trees and a lot more neighborhood, not just this neighborhood.
Here in the South Bronx, you're lucky if you have a safe space to sit outside your house. In a nearby Puerto Rican retirement home, the seniors do have a backyard, but pollution levels are high. Do the residents get to plant much? I ask Betsy Santiago, the supervisor.
We don't have enough space to garden in flowers or whatever. Yeah.
And have tenants been planting any trees, even small trees?
Yeah, they try, they buying, and they give in that season the gardening project, but sometimes it's, you know, it's not grow too much or die, you know.
The main garden is through here. Okay. I don't know if the door's open. I'll leave this here.
A resident called Isabel takes me around the yard. She says the herb garden provides useful ingredients for cooking. It cheers up the residents.
Many are very depressed because they've been uprooted. And that's all they do is look forward to going home on vacation from wherever the Latin country is that they're coming from. Okay, so, and they'll bring, okay, pieces of whatever plants that they can.
Since the conditions are so bad here, it's important to look after the two trees that they have. The seniors have painted the base of the trunks white to decorate and protect them in the Puerto Rican tradition. Nearby tables for domino games sit on a small square of paving. New Yorkers know how to maximize space. In what seems a world away, in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, in an area of hipster bars and artists, there's a far more successful tiny garden. This is the Creative Little Garden, a magical name. It's only about 40 feet by 100 feet square. I'm with Edie Stone from the New York Parks Authority.
There's a very characteristic weeping willow tree in the back of the garden that I would imagine it's about 30 years old now.
And it's about 6 stories high.
It's definitely as tall as the 6-story building behind it. Step down a very orderly row of granite steps onto a crushed granite path that has inlaid bricks that surround some other artistic elements, flowers made out of bent railroad spikes.
And it's very much New York in that we're kind of in a canyon, aren't we?
Absolutely. It's definitely a canyon, and it's going to be even more of a canyon because right now they're in the process of reconstructing one of the buildings on one side to add 2 more stories.
Oh, God. It's a formal garden started by an immigrant woman from Paris, Françoise Châtelet. She came to New York in the 1940s after fighting in the French Resistance.
As much as she was a radical advocate for a lot of things, she was also very much of a French woman who wanted everything always to be just so. And this garden, if you look around, compared to a lot of community gardens, it's quite meticulous.
A picture of Françoise on the fence has become a little shrine, and there are tributes of flowers around it.
Her ashes were actually scattered here when she passed away last year. What better way to respect her than let her spirit reside in this place?
Scattering ashes around a tree is one way an area becomes a sacred site. In some cultures, trees themselves are memorials to the dead. A few years ago, I lived in New York, next to the 580 acres of Brooklyn's Prospect Park. I used to cycle every Sunday at dusk to listen to Afro-Caribbean drummers. The place where they play is called Drummers Grove. Dancers and drummers seem often to be in a trance. This is not a concert. Onlookers are welcome if they show respect. But park administrator Tupper Thomas has a dilemma. She needs to move the drummers because the vegetation here needs a rest. But the symbolic significance wins out.
One of the reasons we couldn't move it from that location because it was getting very large is that they have actually blessed the trees in that area. When a drummer dies, they will bless that tree and his spirit will go on in that tree.
And another regular group sits in a space where there's a circle of logs.
The Haitian community has formed around a stump that was carved by a man who was influenced by God speaking to him through the tree, and they now meet at that area.
My name is Dems Basil. Most of my friends call me Grand Bois because that means forest man. I'm always working with trees. They used to have a stamp, a tree stamp right here, and then my spirit sent me here, and I carved the tree stamp, and everybody coming to enjoy me, and then it's turned like a spiritual place. For me, and when I carve trees, it's like I make the trees come in life again. I find my happiness when I carve in. But the same way, I'm not gonna cut a tree to carve it. A lot of people asking me if I will do another one. But I don't know what the spirit might be saying. But I'm here to save the spirit and the people around me. The people like me too.
I'm here inside a very cute little house, and you can hear birds outside, and you can see trees coming in through the windows. It's like a little cottage, and I'm with...
Dawn Torres, the Director of Youth Programs and Community Outreach.
Orville Minot, Youth Program Manager.
I'm half Puerto Rican and half Chinese.
Jamaican, so I guess I'm African.
They're showing me a book called A Park for All People. There's a photo of Irish dancing on the meadow, another of a German picnic in the woods, and some activities have continued to this day.
First picture represents the Macy's Fishing Contest, an annual event that happens yearly in Prospect Park that brings in numerous students, teenagers.
And Orville and Dawn have started a new project, taking groups to their Audubon Center. For instance, they point out that kingfishers come here from the Gulf of Mexico. It's an imaginative way to talk about social immigration through stories about the birds who fly here.
Both in London and New York, there are some inspired projects at the moment that are really looking to create place. And by place, I mean space with cultural meaning.
Julian Adjeman, the cultural ecologist at Tufts University.
We really need to look at these spaces as places for people to meet. To meet within their group and to meet other people. And I think, you know, community gardens do this in an extremely effective way. You might have a Jamaican gardener next to an elderly Irish man, and they've been doing the same thing for 30 years. They've been sharing crops. Maybe they've even shared dinner together. These people understand each other.
Adjeman says public spaces provide opportunities for reconciliation between groups. Steve Frillman is the director of Green Gorillas, an organisation that advocates for the 600 community gardens around New York. The gardeners are predominantly African American and Latino. When living in a big metropolis gets tough, Steve says, one way you can gain some control and a sense of achievement is through working the earth.
So you plant a tree, and 10 years later, there's this beautiful, wonderful tree that's bearing fruit, and you can pick fruit off of it and eat it. They're on their 5th, 10th, 20th, 30th crop of corn or collards, or the bulbs come up in the fall. There's a certain amount of pleasure that the gardeners have gotten and real satisfaction over creating something that worked.
Communities working together build their own story. 6 years ago, I helped bring a neglected strip of park back to life in New York. It was along the edge of an old, overgrown cemetery. We pruned and lopped branches off the trees, which were blocking the light, and we planted saplings. We put up a playground, an expensive business. To raise money, families bought squares of concrete. Children made handprints in the soft cement and decorated them. There were beads from Africa, glass mosaic squares from Mexico, and my son pressed down tiny shells and pebbles onto his square of cement, memories from a wind-blown British beach. Now our park has a light, airy canopy. The saplings have grown, and the handprints still tell our different stories.
Every Tree Tells a Story was produced by Judith Kampfner. The editor was Sora Newman, and the show was mixed by Jared Weisbrot. This program originally aired as part of the series Tales from Urban Forests, with support from the USDA Forest Service. All the episodes of Tales from Urban Forests can be found on a special website, talesfromurbanforests.org. You can listen to the shows, see pictures, and even download the episodes for enjoyment anytime. That address again is talesfromurbanforests.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. Next time on Soundprint, meet a Hong Kong politician who really is a man of the people. Long Hair, next week on Soundprint. CDs of Soundprint are available. Call us toll-free at 1-888-38-TAPES and let us know what you'd like to hear again. That number again is 1-888-38-TAPES, or you can order online at soundprint.org. What did you think of today's episode? What did you think of last week's episode? What do you think our next episode should be? Let us know by email. The address is talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.